So we now move to the 5th century prophets. The three that we've done only, I'll do now. And then next week we'll finish off the 7th century prophets with Jeremiah, which will take us into a very rich place, continuing on from today in a way, but of course I'll do a little bit more than that. So Zephaniah, firstly, in the last quarter of the 7th century. There are 53 verses in the three chapters of Zephaniah, and six of them I'm offering you over two pages, which is 11%. We're going up. Zephaniah. At that time, I will change the speech of the peoples to a pure speech, that all of them may call on the name of Yahweh and serve him with one accord. From beyond the rivers of Ethiopia, so that's as far as they knew anything, south, my suppliants, my scattered ones, shall bring my cereal offering. This Zephaniah was writing at a positive time of Josiah. The reform, reminding you now, the reform was coming on. Babylon hadn't yet emerged as a problem. Assyria is weakened, so there's a little opportunity there. So Zephaniah tends to be more positive because he's living in a positive time. Chapter 3, verse 13. That was chapter 3, verse 9. Chapter 3, verse 13. They will pasture and lie down, and no one will make them afraid. Twenty years later, Babylon came and wiped out Judah, and Jerusalem only survived because the new young king put a white flag up, and they didn't destroy the city, but they took him and anyone who was anybody off into Babylon to exile. That couldn't be foreseen by Zephaniah, but he was just on the edge of it, so he's able to make such... But he's talking about God's will, you see. It's not what happened, because the Babylonians probably weren't very prayerful. So, chapter 3, verse 17, Yahweh your God is in your midst, a warrior who gives victory. He will rejoice over you with gladness. He will renew you in his love. And then this extraordinary image, he will dance over you with loud singing as on a day of festival. So he's allowing this image of God being so delighted with the people that he says, bring on the band. And he sings, oh, what a beautiful world. Okay. Chapter 3, verse 19 to 20. I will save the lame. I will gather the outcast. I will change their shame into praise and renown in all the earth. At that time, I will bring you home, at the time when I gather you, for I will make you renowned and praised among all the peoples of the earth, when I restore your fortunes before your eyes, says Yahweh. Well, if you're going to consider that prophecy, and we do, but if you're going to think of prophecy as foretelling the future, you can see what you've got to do, and what everyone does is, well, it wasn't fulfilled in the immediate future, and some people are still waiting for it to be fulfilled. So it's actually not a statement about history and what will happen, because that's either random or dependent on the free will of human beings, what we do. But it is saying something about God's will and God's overarching providence and what God would want. Or in Jesus' words, your will be done on earth as it is in heaven. This is the will of God in heaven, but it's a bit like the will of a parent or a grandparent or anyone who loves. It may not happen because Judas may not listen. Jesus can say, friend, why do you betray me with a kiss? And it's a good question, but Judas did it. Now we move to the second prophet of the 7th century, just the one page, I found two verses in it. This is Nahum. Nahum now is rejoicing, you remember? I'm sure you do, over the collapse of Nineveh. The Assyrian capital. So it's gone. It's been by the Medes and the Babylonians. Little did he know that they were going to be next. But anyhow, that's all happened. And he can't get over this long-standing empire that's been a nuisance in the area and done terrible things for such a long time. It's a bit like the joy that probably happened in England, particularly in England, when Hitler lost the war. You know, the kind of joy you have when you've had so much dreadful things happening and at last the enemy's off you. And you're right to be joyful. Well, Nahum is delighting at this. Great poetry, savage stuff, but I managed to find two verses in it that give an image of God that you might like too, or that I'm only not choosing them because you might like them. I'm choosing them because they're the only ones I could find. And chapter 1, verse 7 says, Yahweh is good, a stronghold in a day of trouble. He knows those who take refuge in him. And verse 13 of chapter 1, I will break off his yoke from you, the yoke of Assyria. I will snap the bonds that bind you. And lastly, Habakkuk, who's writing in the last years of that century, and he saw the fall of Jerusalem, though not its destruction, which happened in 587, but he's living through that turmoil period, the same period that Jeremiah lived through, whom we'll start next week and do 2 weeks on Jeremiah. And Habakkuk has 7 verses covering 2 pages here, out of 55 verses in 3 chapters. So that's 12% of the document is what I'm offering you now. Chapter 1, verse 13, Habakkuk says, and this is the first time we have a prophet questioning, what's going on? God, what are you doing? Because from within his perspective, it's and ours too, but more so it's his. And this is what you're going to find, or you won't find it unless I'm still alive and you're still here, when we do the wisdom literature. A lot of the books, I've just about finished the book of Proverbs at the moment, and it's been the hardest one to comment on that I've ever done, because they're little one-liners. And so many of the Proverbs are, they're not real. They're too, you know, the good will prosper and the evil will not prosper. There's a lot of that in it. Then you get Job coming on, and then you get the book of Ecclesiastes, which is a marvellous book, marvellously modern book, because it fits our logical minds and our cynicism, perhaps, and our care of testing things. And they're saying, yeah, no, that's not what the real world's like. So they're questioning. Well, here you've got the, and you get it in the Psalms as well, but this is the first time we've noticed it in the prophets. The beginnings of this questioning, you know, there's got to be more to it than what our parents taught us. Traditional wisdom, inverted commas, traditional ideas about the good flourishing and the evil, and thinking that everything evil is done as a punishment, are you with me? Because that's what we've seen a lot of. Thinking, well, wait a minute, because he's seen beautiful people being punished, hurting. So he's quite, well, okay, back to Habakkuk, chapter 1, verse 13. Your eyes are too pure to behold evil. You cannot look on wrongdoing. Why then do you tolerate the treacherous and are silent when the wicked swallow those more righteous than they? Good question, isn't it? But you don't hear that question till here. You don't hear that in the earlier ones. So there is a development of consciousness going on, I think. You can see that there, surely. And a pondering and a realization that we haven't got God right. We haven't understood this too much. And all the flowery language we were taught is partly, but where are we? And we're still doing that. And hopefully we'll die wondering. And you're going to have the joy, if Karl Rahner is right, and he's definitely the greatest theologian of any century that I know of, when you get to heaven, all of you, and pray for me if you get there before me, and if you get there after me, make sure I'm there, if I'm not, make a complaint. Anyhow, when you get there, you're going to find that heaven isn't arriving, seeing and knowing. Heaven is a uninhibited growing in knowledge, because God's infinite. So it's like an excitement every second of discovery, and a falling in love that gets lover and lover and more loving forever, because there's no sin, there's nothing to stop you, there's nothing to balk anything, and they're all really nice people. Why I said that, I don't know, except I think it's true. So we don't understand God, but thanks to Jesus, we've got an entry that's uniquely wonderful, as long as we don't let the Old Testament scriptures come in, which we tend to do, and people do, and fundamentalists are doing it all the time. That comes in and obscures Jesus. And we say Jesus is God, and we think we know what God is. If you're a mathematician, you'd be balmy. We think we know what God is, so we make Jesus into the God we think we know, instead of looking at God by the Jesus that we know and saying, oh, I see. And cancelling all our wrong ideas of God by Jesus. And he gives us a human, understandable, marvellous, no one would deny beautiful, picture. But it's too good to be true. No, it's not. It's actually true. That's the good news. But our images of God, all cultures, and really most religions, even Christianity, when it's not really lived, we make God in our own image. Or what, as these people did. But here's Habakkuk struggling at least. In chapter 2, verse 4, there's this wonderful line that Paul uses at the end of his chapter 1 of his Romans, and it's key to his argument. The righteous, the right wise, those who are wise and do what is right, lives by his faithfulness. And you might recall last fortnight ago, I made the point that the his there is actually ambiguous. And if you go into the Septuagint, you'll see they take one way of looking at it, and then the different, it goes all in different directions. So I think it's ambiguous on purpose. So the first meaning of it is the righteous live by his, God's, faithfulness. That's what makes our life possible. Not our own, but God's. And we need to be faithful to welcome it. But so it's, or it can also mean the righteous lives by their own fidelity to the covenant. Both are true statements, but you've got to put the first one first. Chapter 2, verse 4 of Habakkuk. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh. Glory always means inner beauty, radiantly obvious. Like you talk about a glorious day. Or your daughter gets married and you know she's beautiful, but when she comes down that aisle, my God, they've been working on her. I mean, she really, you just think, heavens, the beauty comes out. And the bloke up the front, the yobbo who's been drinking beer with the boys, is looking terrific. That's your son. And you feel really proud. Okay, well, glory means beauty, obvious, like a beautiful day or radiant. The earth will be filled with the knowledge of the glory of Yahweh as the waters cover the sea. Chapter 2, verse 20, Yahweh is in his holy temple. Let all the earth keep silence before him. And the last text, which are the last words of the psalm that is there at the end of Habakkuk. Beautiful, I think, is the best statement on faith that's in the whole of the Old Testament. And here it is. When things are going really, really, really bad. Though the fig tree doesn't blossom, you'd love it to blossom, but it ain't blossoming. And there's no fruit on the vines. Though the produce of the olive fails, and the fields yield no food. Though the flock is cut off from the fold, and there's no herd in the stalls. Yet, this is extraordinary, I will rejoice in Yahweh. I will exult in the God of my salvation. Yahweh the Lord is my strength. He makes my feet like the feet of a deer and makes me tread on the heights. Isn't that gorgeous? Well, that's the finish of today. 10 minutes early. God be praised. David, did you want to say something or you just... No.
Good time.
Good. Thank you. And next week, God willing, and you're willing, we'll do Jeremiah, and we'll take 2 weeks over Jeremiah.
Thank you, Michael.
And thank you. Yes.